Call the committee to order in spite of the fact that we still have a number of people missing, and we'll look at the minutes later after we get a quorum. I'd like to introduce Mr. Jansky, Executive Director of Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and Sarah Strawman, Assistant Director. Welcome, both of you, and we'll get started with your presentation right away. If you'd introduce yourselves for the record and begin, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm John Jasky. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and with me is Sarah Strawman, our Assistant Director. Is that working better, Mr. Chairman?
Okay. Yes. Thank you.
I'll try and speak to the microphone. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to present our budget. We've also will do a short agency overview as we work our way towards the numbers that are in the governor's budget for our agency. We will cover the general fund part of our budget, and then Ms. Strawman will cover some of the non-general fund parts of the budget too. We will, you know, go into that in a little less depth perhaps, but we'll let you tell us which things you want to go into in more detail as the presentation progresses. A little bit of background about the two of us. I'm the director. I've been at Bowser for 6 years now as a director. Sarah has been with us for about 3 or 4 months now, I think. She's very capable, and she will be the person that you will see most because she will be up here as the person primarily responsible for the budget and all of our policy work. And I'll be up here as well as needed. Our agency does not have a large staff, so we will be here as needed, but we'll always be available when you need us. My background, I have undergrad degrees in geology and geophysics. Sarah has an undergrad degree in biology. My graduate degree is in public administration. Sarah's is in environmental management, so we've got a lot of experience and background about the things that we're responsible for. I grew up on a farm, a dairy farm in central Minnesota in Morrison County, and Sarah grew up in the city. Now, I live in the city very near where she grew up, and she lives actually out in the, I call it the exurbs, right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, Anoka County.
Anoka County, the city of Ramsey, and unrelated to her coming to Bowser, she also became elected mayor of the city of Ramsey in November. So she's got a night job, too, that's new, and it takes a bit of her time. So she's managing a lot of different things. So prior to my time at Bowser, I worked at local government in Dakota County, a very well-run place, and so we work with local governments as a way we carry out our programs, and so that's a good background. Sarah came to us from the private sector, from the Minnesota Land Trust, a very well-run and respected organization, so those assets that she brings are something that I'm sure you all get to see in the months and years ahead. With that, we'll go into our presentation. We have in your materials this PowerPoint. We also have a couple other things that we'll refer to as our presentation goes forward. We will go into a little bit of depth in places that we think it might be of interest, but you can also probe us more and let us know what you want to have more discussion about as we go through this presentation. We'll do the agency overview. We've got the goals of the agency and our proposed budget, and as I said before, we've got several components to it. I'll cover the general fund aspects of our budget, and Sarah will cover the other funds that are part of our budget, particularly in recent several years. And we'll, as we do that, highlight the programs. And now the way the budget is structured, I'm sure some of you got a chance to pull up the documents from the governor's budget that's in the statewide budget. Discerning the details in there is always most straightforward for folks that haven't, you know, worked with those before. Even for us, sometimes it can be challenging because the way the budget is developed in that structure is through a statewide accounting system now known as SWIFT. And so you see reports coming out of that system that, they're correct, but it's just interpreting how they're correct is what sometimes needs a little more explanation. And so if you have questions about that or how we can help you understand that, feel free to let us know and we'll make sure you get that information. I'm not going to walk through the governor's handouts because I think it's easier to give you something that's a little less detailed than that or more informative. Our agency mission is to improve and protect Minnesota's water and soil resources, and we do that in partnership with local organizations and private landowners. Our programs are focused on private lands conservation, and that's a really important distinction because those are challenges that we see that are sometimes different than if you're working in a public setting, because we have to convince people to do something that's in their best interest and the public's best interest to get cleaner water, to have healthier soil, and to get conservation and habitat accomplished on their own property. Our agency, as I mentioned, is a small in terms of scale, I guess, in terms of what you'll see from some of the other agencies, although we work very, very closely together, and we'll give you some examples of that as well. And you can see as the presentations unfold over the next couple of weeks that there are a lot of interconnections between the agencies. We have a staff of about 80 or so folks. Those people are engineers, they're biologists, they're hydrologists. Of course, we've got some accounting and other administrative functions that are necessary to operate the agency. We've got IT staff. We've got offices in our central headquarters here in St. Paul over on Lafayette Road. We're in the same building as the Pollution Control Agency, in the same complex with the Department of Natural Resources. About half of our staff are in our St. Paul office, and the other half are in regional offices around the state. Duluth and Bemidji, Brainerd, Fergus Falls, Marshall, Mankato, Rochester, New Ulm. So we've got people out there that are working with our local governments to carry out our programs. We have a board that is appointed by the governor, and those folks serve four-year terms, and they operate much like a board does at a local level, where they make decisions about policy, appropriations, and carry out the decision-making of the agency at that level. The staff, myself, Sarah, and our contingent of staff then are responsible through board orders, board resolutions, and of course your appropriation language and other policy changes that might come along to carry out those programs. The focus of really all of the programs is about getting projects on the ground, about getting conservation projects for whatever purpose they may serve, whether it's for water quality, for flood prevention, for habitat improvement. That's the results of what our programs are aiming to do, and I would say in every situation that we can, we'll describe here as we move forward on the presentation. I mentioned our board is governed by this 20-member board. It includes representatives of local government, county commissioners, soil and water conservation district supervisors, watershed district managers, city officials, and we have one township representative. We have three citizens, and then we have five state agency commissioners or other delegates that sit on the board. And the board meets about every month and processes all the decisions that are before it, as I said, regarding appropriations and grants as well as policy. The board has the authority to do rulemaking, as any agency typically does, and so that's a number of things that the board does each and every month. I mentioned we have 81 staff. We actually, if you want the number count, we have 74.5 FTEs currently in the fiscal year 13. Of that, 35 are funded to the general fund, 15 and a half currently by the Clean Water Fund, 3.5 by the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and so the remainder to a various variety of other revenue sources. And we can get you more details on that at some point if that's of interest. We have statutory authority over or with, depending on how you want to look at it, a variety of local governments who carry out the agency's programs and responsibilities. Soil and Water Conservation Districts, there are 90 of them. There are a Soil and Water Conservation District in every county. They are formed along county boundaries. A couple of the larger counties have two in their county. St. Louis County, a very large county. Otter Tail County and Polk County are very large counties that have formed two soil and water conservation districts because of that large geography. They do not have taxing authority, so they're very reliant on state and, to some extent, federal funding and local contributions from their county and other revenue sources, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. Our agency has a responsibility to both create, and if at some point there's a need to disband those organizations, that is statutorily charged to our board. That is through local petition processes, the way those organizations are formed. The watershed districts that have the same similar approach, not exactly the same approach, where a petition is used to request formation of a watershed district, and they do have taxing authority and regulatory authority. We can go into this in some more detail at some point if you're interested, but those organizations have boundaries that our agency is responsible for. They have plans our agency is responsible for. And their financing is really then provided, as I mentioned before, through a variety of sources, including some state funding that comes through our budget. Counties are also part of our responsibility, or we partner with them on carrying out a number of programs. Our natural resources block grant, we'll talk about that in a little bit. Wetland protection is a key part of that. They also are responsible for local water management plans and have had that responsibility since 1986. And we'll talk a little bit later on about an adjustment to that program that was passed in legislation last year and actually shows up as an initiative in the governor's budget this year. So we'll highlight that in a little while. In the metropolitan area, I'm sorry.
Second, Representative Hansen has a question.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chashke, I want to go back to you were talking about the petition issue, and I know it's been a recurring issue for several years with Hennepin County and the Hennepin Soil and Water Conservation District. Efforts to disband or merge that or absorb that with the Hennepin County. And does the agency intend to have any plans or any policy proposals where they would seek to address that situation?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there is some work being done by Hennepin County and our agency and, to some extent, the Hennepin Conservation District to see if there's a way forward there that would work best. There's some unique circumstances there, and it's also the fact that Hennepin County has some of its own statutory authorities that are different than other places, and so we're working on a potential policy bill that might come forward. Hennepin County would lead it. We've been responding to it, and we'll see if that, in fact, comes forward. So back to the presentation, I wanted to highlight, Representative Hansen mentioned the metro area. We do have in Minnesota I think still one of the very few in the nation, a law passed in 1983, the Metropolitan Surface Water Management Act, that compelled a watershed approach to managing water in the seven-county metro area. And we have the responsibility for aligning those boundaries and making sure that those local organizations, which are either watershed districts or WMOs, and a WMO is a watershed management organization, which can either be a watershed district or a joint powers organization of cities or cities and townships. This law now, it'll be 30 years old, you know, come May, has evolved over that 30 years certainly, but the reason it was passed in the first place was that we had, and this is before water quality was really a big issue, and of course now these local organizations are much more focused on that, but there was a time when City A would collect their stormwater off their streets and other infrastructure and put a pipe and dump it over the city line into City B, and City B couldn't do much about it, and so that became a problem, right? We were managing this water on a municipal boundary, and you know, when one would send it to the other, there wasn't really anything that could be done about that. So this law was passed in 1983, and there's rules that have come with it, and we're in the middle of an update to the rules. But that was a very important piece of legislation and has been improved over the years, and now those local organizations are taking on responsibilities beyond just moving their stormwater volume around, but they're also managing for rate control and managing for water quality as well.
Excuse me, Bert. You have listed 46 watershed districts. It seems like a low number to me, considering the potential that we should have. What is a number that you would see that we cover the state? What's the range when the state has watershed districts?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. I can't give you an exact number. Let me give you a couple of factors and then give you an estimate. We have 46 watershed districts. Their scale is quite different. The largest watershed district is up in northwestern Minnesota. It's the Red Lake Watershed District. It actually covers, I think, four, as we would call them, major watersheds, you know, and that's kind of the scale that most people believe. It's about the right scale to kind of plan around. In most places, however, there are other places where that scale is going to be much too large. In a metropolitan area, it's clearly that one of those examples where the metropolitan area, we really would have parts of three major watersheds. And we know that, you know, because of the infrastructure and, of course, even the population, we have to have something a little more local than that. And it is important to be local. And so I guess the scale is, you know, going to be dependent on those factors. If you go to northeastern Minnesota, where we have a lot of public land, you know, you probably don't need as small a scale as you do in other places. I will highlight in an upcoming slide this One Watershed, One Plan initiative. And you will recall personally that there was some push from this committee a few years ago to pursue that, and it has come to fruition last year in policy, and now we're going to be moving it forward in terms of a budget initiative as well. So that will allow watershed approach to either occur via a watershed district, if that's what's needed, or through an agreement between the existing governments.
You've given us the perspective of large and small. Then what we maybe another way to look at it is, how much of the state do these 46 watershed districts cover? That would be another way to view it.
Madam Chair, and what I would do is I'll bring or send you a copy of a map that shows that very clearly. But it's about a third of the state, just geography-wise, and they're not evenly distributed. The Red River Valley area of Minnesota, the river basin that goes from Browns Valley north to the Canadian border to Lake Winnipeg, that is. But for one small area within that basin, there are watershed districts covering it in its entirety. In the metro area, we have watershed districts covering probably three-fourths of the area, or two-thirds perhaps. And in other places, we have, in central Minnesota, we have the Sauk River Watershed District, which lines up with a major watershed. In southwestern Minnesota, we have, in south central Minnesota, we have watershed districts around Albert Lea and Austin. The Cedar River and Turtle River formed watershed districts initially to deal with some flooding. I think flooding was by far the largest factor in formation of watershed districts, and under a law that was passed in the late 1950s. And so, but certainly in more recent years, they've focused on water quality as well. So those provisions in statute to form a water district are there as a petition from, you know, citizens and or county boards that would establish them. We've had in recent years, the most recent change was not to form a new watershed district, but to add an area onto the Buffalo Red River Watershed District near Moorhead in Fargo. It now includes the lower portion of the Otter Tail River, and the upper portion is still not yet in a watershed district. But so sometimes watershed districts aren't formed anew, but their boundaries are expanded as well. We will get you a copy of the map that shows the current watershed district boundaries.
I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
So with that, Madam Chair, I'll move on to the next slide. And so the reason that, you know, our programs and our policies as well are built around using the local agencies to carry out the work is because of a couple of things. One, local governments are the ones that have land use authority in Minnesota. There's no statewide land use authority. I don't think there's any statewide land use authority in the country anymore. Once upon a time, maybe up to about 5 years ago, I think Oregon had a state land use law that the state level organization carried out. But land use authority is critical because the health of our waters is tied to what's happening on the land. I mean, that's doesn't even take probably a real trained person to make those observations. If you see what's in the water, it's going to be a reflection of what is happening on the land. And so how we manage our land is really what drives the quality of our waters. It drives how our waters, the volume of where our water is going to be directed, all of that comes from our land management decision making. Now, the second point here is that we have this local infrastructure there. I mean, they have a connection to citizens. They have the ability to interact with them through local communications. They have property tax records. They have all of the infrastructure to be able to work with people on their private property. And I think that's the key thing here is we have people who have the expertise and they're close to someone who's going to have to make a decision about something on their private property. And generally, people who are making those decisions want to have someone nearby that they can go to and trust and know will be there down the road if something comes up that they need to have given attention. We have, as I mentioned before, each of these local water management authorities have are required to have a water management plan that the state approves, and so that's our responsibility to approve those plans, but more importantly, it's up to the local folks to build those plans and then put together the resources and the implementation mechanisms to carry out the work that those plans say is the highest priority in the places that matter the most. So there are those plans say where the problem is, what to do about it, and where to find resources to get it done over what period of time.
Excuse me, just on that issue, how much are these just surface water plans? Do they incorporate any groundwater protection, a lot of groundwater protection, or just mainly surface water?
Madam Chair, let me make a kind of a dissection, I guess. All of the water plans cover groundwater issues that have a surface groundwater interaction component. So where you have surface and groundwater connected to each other directly, they will include something about those, about that groundwater component. When you get into more of the, you know, the deeper aquifer issues around supply and things like that, or recharge, some do and some don't. And the ones that do, the county water plans, where groundwater is a priority issue, they have incorporated groundwater planning and programming into those plans. Where there's an abundance of groundwater and hasn't become an issue, you know, then they have chosen to focus on other priorities. And so it's optional in those county water plans and watershed plans, but where there is a surface groundwater interaction, there is a component in dealing with that.
I don't know how we determine if there's an abundance of groundwater. How do they determine that?
Madam Chair, going back even to 1986 when the law was passed and moving forward, the local organizations rely heavily on state data to make those plans meaningful and actionable. So even going back to then and continuing, you know, the state agencies, the research institutions, even the federal agencies like the USGS, for example, when it comes to groundwater, have data sets. You know, back in the 1980s, what this literally looked like was they would take all their data and they would hand off these big piles of paper, because that's what we had back then. And so the county then, with some help, or the watershed with some help from state agency or other partners, would try to make the most of that data in an action plan that they would be responsible for. That handoff is really important, and you know, it's getting better all the time. I mean, because we are getting more useful information coming from those sources. I think you can't just hand over a bunch of research data and say, here's something that you're supposed to make sense of and do something about. It's got to be put into a useful form, and we've been shaping those handoffs, and we will continue to do that. I hope you'll hear more about that in the months ahead, about how that's improving, you know, each and every year. So that's the short answer, is that the state agencies, the research institutions, and the federal agencies provide the bulk of that data. Now, local governments also do their own data collection, you know, in some cases. In a lot of cases, actually. They have monitoring programs. Some counties have delegated well programs where they're doing groundwater monitoring. When I mentioned before you were here, or you were, I think, here, Madam Chair, but others may not have been. I worked in Dakota County before I came to Bowser, you know, 6 years ago, and we had the delegated well program. We had a groundwater staff that did the monitoring. You know, there was a lot of information gathered there, and there was critical surface groundwater interactions that had to be managed as well. And so it depends, though, place to place. And so we have other places where they don't have those resources or expertise, and we got to find another way to get it to them.
Well, I would, Dakota County is the shining star when it comes to understanding their groundwater. One of the pieces of testimony that we had during the groundwater hearings was from USGS that said one of our problems was we have some data from each of the agencies, and it's never been brought together, so it is not as useful as it should be. So I think that's one of the things this committee has got to talk about. That's one of the reasons I'm asking you those questions.
Madam Chair, the word useful, I try and use it twice every time I need to use it once, because that's really important, that information, that data we've invested in, that analysis needs to be turned into something that others can use. And it typically, the people creating the data and the analysis aren't the ones that are going to put it into action, so we have to make sure that it is useful, right? And that's, we have some things underway, and this watershed approach, which I'll highlight next, is maybe part of that. And I, you know, that's one answer I don't have yet, and we'll be looking for answers from others. But, you know, to what extent do we want to, or should we expect groundwater to be a component of this watershed approach as we move forward? Because the watershed approach is, you know, of course, surface water delineated. Groundwater regimes, the aquifers, you know, the superficial ones are very much aligned with that, but the deeper aquifers often are not. And on the other hand, if we're doing groundwater management on county boundaries now, that's, you know, that's not any better necessarily, because that doesn't have any connection either. So that's going to be an important discussion about how we connect those two. Because again, the land use decisions are the things that still affect our groundwater resources.
Yes, I just wanted to talk about the information management. And at some point, I think you need to bring MnGeo in here and find out exactly how they're dealing with water information. MnGeo is the part of Minute that deals with geographic information systems, and check at how their funding has, you know, how their funding is. And I know, I think Representative Torkelson was my emissary, and I think he did it very well in making sure that every clean water project had a chunk of its funding going to the information management of it. So I think that's, looking at that trail would be kind of interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't take a whole meeting, but just stick it in somewhere.
Thank you, Representative Hahn. We'll do that. I think they're the two issues, the one of the individual projects, but then I think USGS was being very insistent to us that all this data has not been brought together, and they thought it would be extremely useful if we did.
Well, in Minnesota, the agency that does that is MnGeo, and so they're the people to ask why they haven't or what they need to do it. So
we will make sure that that's on our agenda.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll continue then. This watershed approach, you know, is now a in-state law based on, you know, a direction from this committee that began, you know, I'd say 3 years ago, and then we worked with the watershed districts, the counties, the soil and water conservation districts, and they formed this local water management roundtable and spent probably 2.5 years working on how that really could go forward, so that we were building ultimately plans that were watershed based that many organizations could implement. Again, focusing on that useful information turned into action. And I have to give them credit for working together across those organizational boundaries. We supported their work as best we could, and we came forward with a bill last year. Representative Torkelson carried it, and it did pass, that allows for this watershed plan now to be used over this transition period that we're expecting, you know, probably to be up to 10 years, because we don't want to overnight get rid of all the plans that have just been created and invested in, but we move towards this watershed approach, and we are you know, working with agency partners to figure out how much of that can also include the groundwater aspects. These plans, whether they're a county or a watershed district or a soil and water conservation district or a WMO plan, really take that information and turn it into action. There's only really three things you can do. I mean, either you educate someone or some organization to do something different on their property so they understand more and take actions on their land that contribute to healthier water. We regulate them in some way, shape, or form by saying this is what you can and can't do with some form of regulation, whether it's local or state. Or we provide some financial incentive to cost share to help them with whatever funding they have to be able to do that project for the public benefit that it's going to result in. So that's just the simple outcome of what these plans will contain. And then, of course, the resources to make it all happen. Somebody watch that for me, will you? So, and then again, Madam Chair and members, you know, these plans have become ever more precise. I mean, that is, we've got data sets that now that can help us determine, you know, where the most critical landscapes are that are causing the greatest challenges, you know, both from a water quality perspective, even parameter by parameter. We can use this information to plan where we want to hold water in the land for flood control purposes, and we can also use a lot of this to determine where we have our most critical habitat needs. So that information gets put into these plans and turned into action. This is some very broad scale accomplishments, and I know that this isn't terribly precise for any particular site, but our agency celebrated a 25th anniversary last year. The agency was formed with the merger of three different organizations back in 1987, and the new board was formed. And this is just a list of some of the things that have been accomplished during that 25-year period, which ended this past December. This is an estimate now. We have records, you know, indicating we've got 15,000 conservation practices installed. Well, that's, you know, in addition to a number of those that have been put in place by other organizations, particularly the federal government and a number of local governments that may not have used any of our resources to get those projects installed. We have conservation easements through our Reinvest Minnesota program that are numbering, you know, 6,500 and growing, and that covers 240,000 acres of wetlands and grasslands that provide, you know, multiple benefits for flood control, water quality, and habitat. Like we talked about the water management plans already. Certainly one of the goals, actually, of that legislation that was passed is to reduce the number of plans so that we have more effort that can be aimed at accomplishing the things that are in those plans. We have wetland credits in our wetland bank, and we'll talk more about that down the road, but that wetland banking program is the biggest and best in the country. We started that back in the early 1990s, shortly after the Wetland Conservation Act was passed, and that's been a very useful way to allow folks to have some reasonable use of their land, but also make sure that we're getting equal or better wetland mitigation if, in fact, impacts are going to be authorized. And beginning in 2007, we have this responsibility to do these systematic performance assessments of local governments and their performance on their planning requirements. And so this, now we've accomplished over the past 5 years, we've got a policy bill that will hopefully have a chance to be considered by Representative Jill's committee first, perhaps, just to make a little modification to this to make it more flexible. But it's been very successful. We've initially local governments were worried that we were going to come in and just, you know, be all negative, and that sometimes is needed because there are problems that have to be straightened out. But it's also true that we found a lot of very good things happening and be able to showcase that and show others how to achieve success the way those that are already there have has been a very useful tool.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jashke, the 15,000 conservation practices installed, do you have a number on how many are maintained or how many still exist?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have that number. We could make some attempt to try and get an estimate. It would be an estimate. These projects are funded with a contract that then requires those practices to be there for whatever, you know, the contract says. Typically, it's 15 years. So, you know, once that time period is passed, there's no obligation to keep it there. However, you know, many of them are retained for much longer than that, and some of them have to actually be maintained as well. So we'll see what we can find on that, but I'm expecting that the majority of them are still there. But I know that, you know, maybe more recently, actually, we've had, because of the pressure, particularly in the ag areas with the land values, you know, I know there's been some of them that have been removed because they have no obligation anymore to keep them. And we do make every attempt to, you know, build durable projects so that you build it once and then it's there, and the contract obligation is fulfilled simply by keeping what you had. But we'll see what we can find for you on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jashke, let's say you have a 10-year contract for a grassed waterway, mm-hmm. and it's installed, public pays for the design and the cost share, and you have SWCD that goes out and staff go out and look and discover that it's not there anymore. What's the consequence? Is there a repayment to the district board by the landowner? Or is it their attempt to have it reinstalled if it's during the contract, not if the contract is passed and there's no contractual obligation, but what happens with compliance if that practice that someone has signed their name to and a board has voted on is no longer maintained?
Madam Chair, Mr. Hansen, if it's a violation of the contract, then the first step is to have that local contract authority, the Soil and Water Conservationist, because what you described it, take action to, you know, really first remediate it by putting it back if it can be put back. Secondly, if it were if that was not possible or the person was not willing to do that, you know, then you look at a repayment or a payback of the money, and that would come back to local folks and then back to the state, because that's where the money came from. These projects all have a landowner portion of the funding, you know, typically 25%, let's say, just to make it an easy number to think about. So, you know, part of it is that their own investment is at risk too, so that helps keep some of that, I mean, most of it to a minimum. We don't have that's very, very rare. But once the contract expires, you know, then there's really no obligation for anybody to monitor it because the contract's over, and so I don't have a good handle on that kind of data. That's why I'm wondering what we can get you, but we'll do our best.
Madam Chair, one final question. With the federal Farm Bill direct payments going away and the connection between direct payments and conservation compliance or swamp buster and sod buster, what happens to conservation practices that are in that period after a contract where maybe they're restored wetland that's not on a permanent easement or a wetland that's been protected because the landowner would lose payments if they drained that wetland? And if that goes away, what's the impact when we're in the crop insurance world rather than the direct payments world?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, you know, the Federal Farm Bill, of course, is still in, you know, we've got there was an extension made through the end of September, and there'll be presumably a new Farm Bill passed by Congress, I guess, if they can get that done before then. And the issue that's being discussed now is if you look at the number of agricultural producers that are producing, you know, commodity crops right now, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 90%+ of them are participating in the federal farm program and getting some payment of some sort. And one of the more common ones is direct payment, as it's known. If that is no longer part of the federal farm bill, that means that, from what I was told by Mr. Paul Flynn at NRCS, that we will go from over 90% participation down to somewhere in the 20% participation. So that means the compliance aspects of that federal farm program related to swamp buster, the wetland protection, or the highly erodible land that will no longer be in place for those people who are no longer in the farm program. So that means the burden's going to fall back onto the state, or there won't be protection for those things potentially. So that is a big policy issue we're working on some plan A, kind of plan B, to see what that looks like, because we can't predict what Congress will do, but we have to be ready because they'll have something. They'll have done something or nothing, I guess, by September of this year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to comment on that, what I've read or followed, the issue of cross-compliance, even if direct payments would go away, but they will be with us yet next year, but even if direct payments go away, the crop insurance subsidy would be tied or could be tied to cross compliance. So I don't think that's. I think it's an issue that will stay with us in terms of if crop insurance is the only monetary benefit available to farmers, and if they tie that to cross compliance, I think that would remain largely the same as it is now with the direct payments.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I would agree with you in that currently, however, an existing farm bill, crop insurance is not tied to compliance, so we have to have a change. So we don't know if they make the change, you know, swapping it. Basically, as you described, I think you're absolutely right. But we can't figure out what Congress is going to do, so we have to kind of be ready for different options. Madam Chair, I'll continue then, if that's okay. Our agency goals. You know, we could have just put one goal on here because number one is really what we're about. And all of those, you know, beneath it really support number one, which is protecting the things that are going well and improving those that aren't, with our water and soil resources. Again, making that point about the land and water connection, and making the point about, you know, working with private landowners on land and water that they're responsible for and have some expectations of as well. Point number two, or goal number two, is in order to do that, we rely on our local organizations to accomplish, you know, our program delivery, and so making sure that they are as well prepared as they possibly can be is a key part of that. Just as you would if you had employees or contractors working for you, you want to make sure that they were well trained and organized and accountable, and we have that same approach, you know, to making sure that our local governments are ready to do all of that, and by and large, they are terrific. We provide training. Of course, they can do a lot of these things on their own as well, but we do provide a systematic a training program. You know, we'd like to make it bigger, but it's always limited by resources. We hold an academy each year. We get several hundred local government staff to come to that. We do that through one part of a week so that everybody can sort of get it all at one time as best as possible. We do that late in the fall when their field work is less busy, and when we can actually get a cheap rate on a facility too, which is also helpful. And we also conduct a number of other trainings and certification programs, you know, during the year. But that's been a critical part of our, you know, our recent focus, is making sure that they're ready to do the best they can, and helping them to get to that point, both technically, as you know, I was describing, but also as Representative Hansen was describing in the oversight approach that we take to making sure that their organization is ready to go. And by and large, they value that attention from us when we take on that that review of their operation. Goal number three is, again, the evaluation. You know, if you're going to make sure you're doing the most important thing well, you have to make sure that your means of doing it and your methods are constantly evaluated. And if something needs a course correction, then you're able to make it. If you're not paying attention to that or measuring it, then you are not going to be able to know which course corrections are needed or where. So we have, we've worked with both the research institutions and others to come up with ways to do this, and some of it was done ourselves. We recently hired a organizational development person whose responsibility is to make, you know, all of what we do better. We will be spending more time in the future on these measures. We know that that's critical. And measures, you know, some of them are final measures, like, you know, is the water cleaner in this place? Some of them are steps towards that final measure, which is, are these organizations, are these projects, are they being planned, designed, and constructed, you know, to the highest level of what we can expect them to be? So there's a lot of different aspects of where we measure in effectiveness, but in the end, you know, the result is often on the land or in the water. Agency goal number four, and this one is highlighted here just because it's a little bit different than some of the others, and this was something that was added to our responsibilities about 5 years ago. We have in Minnesota a vast network of public drainage systems. And that's this was all started with laws that were passed now 139 years ago to move water, you know, off and around and through our landscape so that land could be counted on for economic purposes, both rural, mostly, you know, back then, and now even more recently, you know, urban drainage. So we have these public drainage systems. Minnesota has a unique situation where these drains, as they're called in other places, are overseen as, you know, in a trustee fashion by counties or watershed districts. We have this law that says there's a trustee of this infrastructure, which is really built for, you know, private benefit largely, although, you know, of course, road authorities use that drainage system to move water off of their infrastructure. So we've had this drainage system in place well over a century. And it was at the time, and even today, really critical that that water be able to be moved off the land. But we're also, you know, now in more recent years, learning that we've got to find ways to store and treat some of that water too, because obviously if it is moving off these landscapes, it's going somewhere else, and somewhere else is downstream, and somewhere downstream it might have a problem. So we have to manage it further up into the watershed. So we have a drainage work group that we convene, and they include all the agencies as well as federal partners, and also a lot of the local governments, and even some of the interest groups participate in this. And so it's a big job, because, and I can show you a map at some point too of the infrastructure that's out there, but it is, you know, many, many thousands of miles, and then many millions of feet of underground systems that also drain into these surface waters. So, in fact, we had a bill that is already on its way. Representative Hansen had a bill, House File 66, which, you know, moved out of this consensus process. So we know that this is a huge part of the drainage and water management network. For the past, you know, over a century, it's been managed in isolation from everything else, and this work group and our responsibility for it is to kind of integrate it a bit more, because you can't manage water systems, you know, piecemeal. You have to manage them on a watershed scale. And, you know, we'll say this, that this is the one thing in Minnesota law that's been managed on a watershed basis for 139 years. They were designed and built with steam shovels and hand shovels, but they were doing it on a watershed basis back then. And finally, we have the responsibility to make sure that the state's investments, are able to be known by those who are providing the funds, and that they're being managed with prudency, and that the citizens who are paying for them value and understand what they're getting for their investment. And so communicating that and showing it in ways that people understand and appreciate is important. That's something that we are doing more of, but more importantly, we're asking local governments to help with that, because these things are very local. A water quality project, a flood control project, it may not matter, 100 miles away to someone. They may not even know about it, but it really does matter to someplace local. So those local stories about what's going on are things that we're, working with local governments to do more of. Okay, here's finally a budget picture. And this is a broad-scale description of our budget, and both I and Sarah will go into a little bit more detail on these, and you'll tell us how much more detail you'll want. The chart on the left shows the total agency budget, just in total, inputs. And you can see that, the largest part now, if you think of it that way, is from the Clean Water Fund, and Sarah will talk more about that later on in our presentation. The general fund, which is what I'll be focusing on, is about a quarter of our budget. There are other state funds, and this is a snapshot. What we expect, coming ahead, but things for what's coming ahead yet aren't yet certain, because of course your work is just beginning. And then we also have some federal funds that are proposed to be part of our revenue sources for the upcoming biennium. If you look at the chart on the right, this shows where the money goes. In broad terms, we have a small staff. We have a larger budget relative to that, because 88% of our funding goes to local governments to do projects and programs in those local, supporting those local plans and getting things done through their operations. And 12% of it is for our agency operations. So the general fund, and this is just kind of going a little bit narrower with each slide here, which is what I'll focus on in the governor's recommendations. This describes the four categories, the way the budget is structured, and then each of these categories have subcomponents to them, where we start to get more into the specific programs. Here they're sort of rolled up into these four larger categories, and this is what you will see when you look in the governor's budget. You will see these numbers for these four categories.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jashke, looking at the 14-15 general fund, in the current biennium, we had changes that took line items within your budget and eliminated them. For example, there was a buffer program that was general funded and disappeared, and there was, I think, assistance for local governments relating to county weed management, and that disappeared. And there are a number of small boards and commissions that I think were cut. And the answer at the time was, well, those are going to be rolled into general cost share or things will still happen. Can you break down what has happened with those dollars that where the line items were eliminated they went into the general pot, which was also cut, if I remember correctly?
Madam Chair, Representative, if you would just give me a moment to get, I've got some slides upcoming that I think will have a little bit more detail about that, and I'll try and cover it there if that's okay. I won't forget your question.
Okay. Representative Hamilton has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was reading through the 14-15 governor's budget here, and the way I read it, it said the changes on admin and agency operations, there's a 28% increase, and I'm just curious on how that breaks out, where that's going and why.
Madam Chair, Representative Hamilton, there is some work still being done with this, that aspect of the, of our budget and others, because there were some things that I understand to be, have been double counted, because the, for example, the Clean Water Fund was zero based, and so it got counted twice, and so we'll have that, I think, corrected, or at least clear for you in the maybe a week, next week, maybe even sooner than that. Is that correct, sir? Okay. So let me look at that more carefully, but I want to make sure we get the current information to you before we have that conversation, if that's okay. Okay, I'm sure I'll continue. So I'm going to try and break down each of these categories a little bit, and you can each, you know, they can all be broken down even further if necessary. So this budget category, resource protection rules and laws, there's really sort of three components in here, and even some of them have more than one component. The natural resources block grant is a line item that is a grant that goes to counties, at least initially, and they often pass it on, in some cases, to soil and water conservation districts for specific program delivery. These are programs the state has mandated that local governments or counties carry out. It's wetland protection, it's shoreline protection, it's feedlots, it's septic systems. This grant program has been used to basically put together these various programs that counties are responsible for and give them a block grant. And we also have on occasion, through interagency transfers, you know, put more funding into this program if it's available. You know, and we work with the Pollution Control Agency on the SSTS and feedlot and the DNR and the shoreline protection grants. They get bundled into one grant that goes out to counties, and then they report back on the activities they carry out under each of those programs. The Wetland Conservation Act and our wetland banking programs, we have the responsibility to oversee the wetland protection program, which is a joint state and local program. We have responsibility for participating in what are known as technical evaluation panels, where people have to go on site and make wetland delineation determinations and review wetland replacement plans for where they may be proposing to fill or drain a wetland and offset it with another wetland somewhere else, potentially using the wetland banking program more so now than ever. That wetland banking program has been utilized to accomplish that, and that's actually been a good thing because we get higher quality sites that we know are going to be there perpetually, protected by a state conservation easement. The federal government, the Corps of Engineers, has enacted a rule a few years ago that also acknowledges our wetland banking program as the preferred alternative for wetland mitigation. And we also, in the last year or so, have created a wetland banking program specific to agricultural impacts because of the differences that you see there, where you're going to replace a wetland that may have been impacted or going to be impacted in an ag setting with another one in an ag setting. And so that program is growing. We've got about six sites now in that system where the people that put the credits in the bank are only going to sell them to ag producers. And so there's a more straightforward exchange there. The general wetland banking system, anybody can participate. Any person that wants to build a wetland and then have it enrolled in the bank and then sell credits to someone who is looking to acquire some because they are getting a authorization to drain or fill a part of a wetland. I pretty much covered the drainage law and drainage authority issue in my prior slide, but again, there's policy that's part of that, but also there are projects now that are being built. In fact, this bill if it progresses to a law, would for the first time allow a drainage authority to actually participate financially and sponsor a project on a drainage system that was going to provide some clean water or some storage. You know, makes good sense, but you know, the current law does not allow that. Someone else has to actually be the project sponsor. So one of those trustees, the county or the watershed district, couldn't do that as a drainage authority. They could do it as another organization, which this will help that along. I should highlight too, although it's
just
really,
for a moment.
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry to keep interrupting you, John. On the wetland banking, can a landowner restore a wetland through a WRP RIM contract and use that same wetland for a bank, or is that prohibited?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that is prohibited by law, that you cannot, conservation dollars cannot be used to, cannot be used, period, to do wetland mitigation.
One more question, Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair McGinnis. Mr. Jasky, I'm going to ask a question. I've been on this committee, this is my 11th year. I should know the answer to this. But if a private individual had a piece of valuable wetland, and the let's say a city, a county, township, local unit of government, private individual, corporation had a area that qualified as a wetland, and they put a conservation easement on it, voluntarily put a could they then sell credits to someone who needed them, whether they be in the mining industry in Minneapolis, St. Paul, or in the ag industry? Would that qualify for a part for banking by putting a conservation easement permanently protecting the wetland? How would that get structured, or is it possible?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, it is possible, but there's a set of conditions that have to be met, and the conditions are, number one, that option only exists in northeastern Minnesota, where we have an abundance of wetlands, because elsewhere in the state there's plenty of opportunities to do restoration. Secondly, it has to be a threatened wetland in some way, shape, or form. So there's a clear and present threat that you're going to stave off by protecting it with this conservation easement. And so, and thirdly, it has to be a high value wetland. It has to, there's certain criteria, you know, our white cedar wetlands and things like that that really are unique and special, that they're threatened and the threat is real and present. Then the fourth condition is there's only a partial credit given. And this has all been built into law now. Yeah, basically it's a 1/8 ratio. So if you protect, you know, 8 acres with this option that you described, you get 1 acre of wetland credit. And this is something that was worked out with both the federal agencies first, and then we came actually to the legislature several years ago now, and this legislature passed that into law, making that option possible. And it's rarely used, but in certain cases up in northeastern Minnesota, it is working well. I know that the city of International Falls, which of course is, you know, kind of got a wetland all in and around it, is expanding some of their infrastructure, and they didn't really have any place to go make another wetland because the whole area is really already a wetland around their city. So they found this place that otherwise could have been threatened and worked to find a way to protect it with a conservation easement and got some credits that they were able to use for their future development around their city.
Okay. Thank you for that. Well, you zeroed right in on what I was going at, and they're trying to do it again. Out in the Red Lake Forest on a private parcel that's totally surrounded by state land. Mm-hmm. And they're meeting resistance. So I'll be talking to you about that, because I knew it was one. I knew there you could get only 8-for-1, or 1-for-8, I mean. Mm-hmm. Be easier at 8-to-1 the other way. But anyway, thank you for that. I just wanted to make sure that was, but you said that was only applicable in the Northeast. Because we have, is that in zone 1 and 2 then only, or how does that, is that, tell me about that, and then I'll set that up.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, it's actually in a greater part, I mean, in all of northeastern Minnesota, we will have this zone that's known as the greater than 80% area. So basically from Pine County through Crow Wing County and all the way up through, you know, to just East Representative Fabian's district is where that area goes, where they have most of the wetlands that were ever there are still there. So that's why. and we'll have to talk more about the specific site, but it does, it's a high test to get credits for something that's already a wetland, because it has to have that threat, it has to be high value, and so those are important standards that have to be met.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to highlight one more thing here, although it's really policy-driven, and since Representative Dill brought it up, you know, the governor last May issued this Executive Order 12-4, and we presented the summary of that to Representative Dill's committee, but, you know, there's a lot of stakeholders that are part of the Wetland Conservation Act program. It's now been around for 21 years. It was passed in 1991, and it's been evolved a great deal since, and so, you know, the point here in the budget presentation is that work is important. It's achieved wetland protection that would otherwise have not been there. And, you know, now we're also responsible in our agency for restoring wetlands under Reinvest Minnesota programs. We want to make sure that we achieve no net loss, so we aren't just filling holes. We're actually going forward. And then here is trying to go back a little bit.
Excuse me, Representative McNamara, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did, Madam Chair. Thank you. It was to Director Jaski's last point. With the task force that the governor put together with his executive order, they had some recommendations about following up on the modifications, the slight modifications that were made to WACA last year. And it sounds like we should be looking for a recommendation from you on furthering some of the work of the last year. Do you know when that'll be coming from your organization?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, Representative Dill asked the same question a week and a half ago, and I said we needed 30 days to get some work done because, you know, this report just was finished in, you know, mid-December, and of course getting folks together over the holidays was not going to be quite likely, so we had working on the budget. So I hope to have some, we have a plan, we have a matrix showing, you know, the various components that have been brought up in the report, and the options for addressing them, some of them are statutory, some are potentially rule, and some are administrative, and so we are trying to slice and dice this to make sure we're discerning the things that need legislation and then getting those ready to come before your committees and talk to you about those. So I'm hoping that we'll have something I guess we now got 20 days, right, since that was 10 days ago. We're working on it.
I trust that as you are proceeding, that the two kind of missing pieces of that report were how groundwater is affected. That was not in the report by the proposed actions, or looking at some of the statutory requirements for carbon. So before those come forward, I hope that there's a remedy to that lack. Do you want to go forward?
One more thing, Representative McGee. Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just an editorial thing here about the executive order. In 11 years of being in the legislature, I don't think I've had a single thing like this ever happen. When I represent four counties that have 80% or greater of their wetlands, and that each one of them came to me and said, "This was really good work that those folks did." I wanted to compliment them on that, and I just wanted to say that I was in shock when Wade Pavlik wrote me a note, commissioner from Coochin County, and said that they had no problem with the report. So that you have accomplished something, Director Jaski.
Madam Chair, now I'm a little bit worried, but we'll deal with Mr. Pavlik. I think there, you know, it is the thing that has happened over the 21 years is that the law has been crafted to recognize the very disparate and different landscapes we have in Minnesota relating to wetlands. I think that's the really important point here, is that there are places where, I mean, every part of Minnesota is quite different in the wetland resources we have. So the law has been structured to try and address that, and it keeps getting better, I think, each time we take some further look at it. Madam Chair, I'll continue then. This chart here shows just the components and, you know, giving a little bit of history on the past biennial amounts for each of these budget categories. And, you know, the, of course, since the one number is larger, it makes the other ones a little harder to discern. But you can see that, you know, the past biennium, the block grant in particular, you know, was you know, it's less than what it was by, you know, some percent, maybe 20%, and that's typical of all the things that will be in the governor's budget. The governor is not proposing any reductions in this item or any of the other items in our budget, so this is a reflection of the past biennial appropriations. The next budget category is our is local water management, and this again is where, you know, we have several things, you know, kind of rolled up in here, and I'll try and break this down a little bit. And this is, I think, the one that Representative Hansen asked about, so I'll remember to do that here. The first item is what we refer to as our conservation delivery program, and that is a program that is for soil and water conservation districts. This is funding that the state provides. If you recall in my opening remarks, you know, I mentioned that soil and water conservation districts are special purpose governments, but they do not have any unique taxing authority, so they rely on contributions from the county governments, from the state, and this is the state portion of that contribution. It once upon a time was in the neighborhood of about a third of their budget, and now it's been, of course, it's gotten to be less than that. And the USDA, which is the other bigger component of their budget, is also now getting smaller. So they're under some fiscal stress. This is a critical component of their operation, so that we have this base capacity there ready to respond to issues that that are important locally in their water management plans. But we rely on them, for example, in the recent floods. You know, these staff are ready and able to respond immediately to something like how we catalog the needs for the flood damages that may have occurred. And for example, this past summer, you know, we got people on the ground immediately, you know, inventorying the needs, and we're able to roll that information up into really precise data that we could bring to the legislature during special session to show them where the problems were, what the estimated costs were going to be. So we actually had real numbers to provide in a matter of a week or two to the policymakers on what we believe were the needs that were going to be on the landscape once the water receded. So having them available to do those things as well as their local water work is critical, and the state provides a portion of that funding. That's the biggest item in this category. Representative Hansen asked about these regional planning authorities. The Red River Basin Commission is a entity that's actually an international organization that wed North Dakota, Manitoba, and Minnesota together to manage the Red River Basin, not only in Minnesota, but of course in North Dakota, and it goes into Canada. They actually have the ability to move money and programs across that international border, which none of the states would have except through a treaty. So that's been a very useful thing to have. They've done a lot of work to plan flood protection levels up and down the basin. We now have a 20% reduction goal of the peak in the Red River that has now been distributed to all the watersheds upstream. So it's both a matter of volume, storing water, but also of timing. So knowing where to put that storage, because if you put it in the wrong spots, you can have the water actually stacking up on top of itself and making a problem worse. So it's really critical that we know how much to hold back and then where to hold it and when it can be released. And so the Basin Commission has been instrumental in preparing the information to make those decisions. In the watershed districts in the Minnesota side and the joint water boards on the North Dakota side are responsible largely for finding those sites and building those projects. They're also now incorporating, or this because of this work there, and we're incorporating use of wetlands to achieve a good bit of that storage, you know, a more dispersed amount of storage. You know, we're still based on the work that this organization did, you know, the Fargo-Moorhead situation requires a diversion because that's a huge community that has to have something it can count on. But the cost of a project like that, or the increased level or decreased level of risk if you can achieve by getting water stored in the upstream areas, is clearly cost beneficial, and they've got now the information to prove that.
Excuse me, Representative Fabian, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Jasky, I'm obviously very interested in the Red River Basin and the management goals and so forth there, the 20% reduction in peak flow, and and you mentioned where to put water and identifying areas. Excuse me. and we've had this conversation before. One of the things that I'm interested in pursuing, and I'm kind of beating a dead horse, but for example, in Roseau County, we developed the Hay Creek Norland retention area, 8 square miles, basically private land went into developing that retention area. And of course, within the 8 square miles, there were some wetlands, and had to mitigate the wetlands, you know, against the project, you might say, as you well know. So then we take 8 square miles of basically private land, we take it off the local tax rolls, and there is a benefit, obviously, the flood protection, I get that. But inside of those retention areas, you know, we're kind of in a way creating a wetland, and it would really be helpful to get these projects more online if we could develop some sort of a system for creating a wetland and selling credits out of those retention areas to help defer the costs of creating these retention areas. And I'm just curious to know what your perspective is, and if you want to talk more offline, that's mm-hmm. fine, but it's an issue that continues to be very important in the Red River Basin, and the areas that are available are sometimes limited.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, yeah, you know, we actually, I think, the horse isn't dead yet if you're beating it. There actually is a point there. There was a tour.
Thank you.
A tour that, you know, the Red River Watershed Districts collectively put together and sponsored last September, I believe it was. And so I was up there along with the Commissioner of DNR and PCA, and we actually brought the Army Corps of Engineers, the Colonel, came along, and we looked at a couple of those sites. Actually, just we looked at one on site and a couple, you know, through a slide presentation. And with the right design and with, you know, the proper planning, I believe we can get some multiple things off of those sites, you know. And so, and I think we've made some headway with particularly the federal government, which has been the biggest challenge because they have, you know, national standards that have to be applied unless they can come up with a regional one that they can make a case for. And so I believe that is improving. You remind me though to check with my counterpart at the Corps of Engineers, Tamara Cameron, and see what they have done, because I don't have that information with me, and I don't even have it in my office, so I will ask her next time I see her and get back to you on that.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, then I will. So the amounts of funding for each of these organizations are, you know, really for their organization as a regional authority to have a state contribution. In the case of River Basin Commission, the $100,000 per year in the Minnesota budget would be matched by both North Dakota and Manitoba as a contribution. The Minnesota River Joint Powers Board is a regional entity that, of course, is focused on the Minnesota River. It's a joint powers of counties. They are right now, and they're administered by the Minnesota State Mankato Water Resources Center. That's their agent that does their planning work and basically helps them as a group of county commissioners get things done. Now they are doing, as we speak, I'll call it a self-assessment of what they want their future to be, because they've had some challenges with the membership. You know, they're wanting to make sure that they, as a joint powers board of counties, is doing something that is noticeable and important. You know, that may be something that's already being done by Minnesota State Mankato, because the staff are doing a lot of the work. You know, the question is, you know, what is that joint powers board, you know, actually accomplishing? And so we will be finding out more from them after they finish their self-assessment, which I think is going to be presented to their members at the February 11th meeting in Gaylord. So we will find out where that's at. But they are in this budget proposed to receive a $43,000 per year grant, which they use to, you know, to seek other funding as well. Area 2 Minnesota River Flood Control is an area of joint powers, 9 counties in southwestern Minnesota that all feed into the Minnesota River, but they have these regional flooding issues in southwestern Minnesota. And this organization, Area 2, was, you know, it's the name of it doesn't really tell you where it is, but it was created based out of a study that was done by the federal government back in the 1960s, and they created this flood control region, and it's funded by a portion of state funding. They get bonding dollars to build flood control projects, and they also get local county contributions to make that organization keep those projects viable and build more. They do a lot of smaller scale things, you know, a lot of road crossings where they were able to add more water. They the landscape there requires to do a lot of small dispersed structures in most cases. You can see there's, I'll just say there's a picture here of, you know, kind of a group of people looking at one of them, but I'll take your question.
Yeah, there is a question. Representative Corkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Jaski, very interested in Area 2. It's got a long history of putting in lots of projects. And what I've been trying to assemble and haven't had much luck getting it is some evaluation of the impact on that watershed of the projects that have been installed over the years. There's a lot of good small projects of you, as you have highlighted, but no one's really seen to look at the old, you know, the broad impact of those projects that have been installed, and I would like to enlist your help in acquiring that information.
Madam Chair, that's a good suggestion, and we'll work on that with the folks that are the staff at the Area 2. And you're right, I mean, it's the scale is a factor because the localized flooding is critical too, but they are a regional entity, and so you're right, we ought to be able to have a regional set of outcomes from them, and that's what we'll work on.
Along with that, did you finish, Representative?
I'm done.
Appears to be a presentation about inputs, and I expect you're going to do outcomes on our Tuesday meeting. So if we could have just a small report or a report for Representative Torkelson at that time, that would be helpful. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this kind of follows up on Representative Torkelson's question. We talked earlier about having watershed districts where at a watershed level decisions are made, and those watershed districts are relatively recent compared to Area 2 development. And so as a state, as the general taxpayers have been putting money into Area 2 for many decades, and with general obligation bonds putting general tax dollars into Area 2. But is the model similar to what is being done with watershed districts, where watershed districts actually tax themselves to leverage the federal dollars or to leverage state dollars so that the people who are benefiting from the flood control or the watershed management are paying for it, rather than having the general tax dollars go into a watershed district? Looking at these budgets over time, when we have outcomes, all the people of Minnesota are funding Area 2, but with the 46 watershed districts, they tax themselves to achieve the same goals that the folks in Area 2 do that are not taxing themselves for those benefits. Is that correct? Is there something that prohibits that, or is it just because Area 2 was created in the 60s and we're continuing that model when another model hasn't been considered or is not possible to be considered?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, actually, Area 2 does have local tax dollars into their organization. It's counties that levy their taxpayers and then they bundle it into this joint powers agreement, and so there is a local contribution to these projects and the maintenance of the projects, and they have gotten bonding money from the state to do that. You're right, it's not, and if you look at other places where they've got flood control needs, there are more watershed districts, and I guess one could say that maybe some of the watersheds that are part of Area 2 could take on that part of the responsibility, but they're not formed in that whole area, so you have to have some changes to do that. The counties, though, are putting their local tax dollars into Area 2 as the match, so there is a local contribution. Madam Chair, the next item here I do want to highlight, because this is one of the initiatives in the governor's budget, the One Watershed, One Plan, and I'll just talk about what that consists of. The governor's budget presents a increase of $450,000 per year, and what that would be used for is to move the local governments that aren't operating on a watershed scale towards that. And this, in the metropolitan area, we have the watershed approach already well on its way. This would largely take place in greater Minnesota, and it's really critical that we organize it in a way to make the best use of the information that is being generated, both for flooding purposes, but more specifically for water quality purposes. And you'll hear, as part of Clean Water Fund presentations from our agency and others, the the monitoring and assessment work and modeling, it's all being put in place to know where the water quality problems are and what the solutions are going to be and where they're going to need to be on the land. That information needs to be built in to these watershed, comprehensive watershed management plans. That's what this, that's what is the expectation for local governments and I think from the state perspective. So this funding would be used for two things. One, it would be used to have, in the way it's proposed, two FTEs in the state at our agency responsible for getting these underway, because it's going to take, as I said, probably 10 years to begin and move through that transitionary period from county-based plans to a watershed approach. And the other part of that funding would be used to provide some incentives to the local governments who would be part of that to have them take on the extra work to move in that direction and get more projects built. So that's the initiative that's in the governor's budget, is at $450,000 per year. And it follows on the policy bill that was passed last year.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Director Jasky. I'm really glad to see the governor put that as a priority and an initiative to move to watershed, but I'm disappointed in the timeline. Is there a possibility that this doesn't really need to take a decade to take place? Can't that be done at the most over a couple of bienniums?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, it may be able to be done faster than that. In some places, it certainly will be. What we want to be careful that we don't do, though, is, you know, overload the system or discard things that were just recently completed that are well done. And so there's two challenging aspects to it. The first one is, you know, working across geopolitical boundaries, having, you know, counties work among and with each other. And that's going to be, it takes some time to get them to understand how that can be effective. The counties have the ones that have the most change to make here, along with the stormwater conservation districts. And so they've supported this idea. We've seen some places where we know it's likely to be successful, or maybe already is. If we can go faster than 10 years, that'd be terrific. I can't see that, you know, with a guarantee that it would be, because the plans right now that we require them to adopt are 10-year plans, so they would have to, you know, discard part of their plan and start over in some ways. We don't want to have them waste useful things they've already accomplished.
Just real quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. So in some watersheds, they could take place quicker than 10 years, and some might need more work. I understand that, and you hopefully would prioritize where it would be the most benefit for the land by doing it quicker. What about, have you brought in the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Township Association? I would think that we would want their buy-in and hopefully would get their support, and they would see this as beneficial too. Has that already been happening?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, on the county's part, certainly, as I mentioned before, the Association of Minnesota Counties, Association of Minnesota Watershed Districts, and the Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts formed this local government roundtable going on 3 years ago now, I think it was, to do that very thing, is to get together and figure out how to build something in policy that would allow them to work in a watershed scale with those geopolitical realities in place. So yes, that's there. I also want to make one more point about the 10-year statement that I made. Going back to, we want to use the data and analysis that's being done. So if you recall, the Pollution Control Agency is on this 10-year cycle of monitoring, assessing, and putting forth the information that these local governments then would use. And so we want to have this follow behind that work, you know, that way it's immediately useful and can be turned into action. So that's another reason that I'm using the 10-year time frame as the most likely transition period that we would be looking to. But it, some places it can go faster than that, you're absolutely right.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along those lines, Commissioner, how are the other agencies relating to this one watershed, one plan idea? And is all the staffing going to be within your agency and the other agencies kind of cooperate, or is there no cooperation?
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, no, there is absolutely cooperation that is present and will need to grow, and commitments have been made for this approach. We work very carefully with the Pollution Control Agency and the DNR and Department of Health, Department of Agriculture on this. And the idea that is that we don't need a lot more. We need just a little bit more to get this going, because the current plans will continue. The resources that are committed to them will be, you know, directed to the watershed approach. There will be, you know, think of it as a county will maybe feel like it's more work, because you will have, instead of one county plan, you will have a, you will have to be a participant in, you know, two or three or four different watershed plans. And so, and the same with the soil and water conservation district. So we want to, you know, say yes, that's understandable, but, you know, you're already managing your water on a watershed scale, so it's really just organizing your plans around that, and then your actions will follow through. So we believe that the coordination is there and will continue.
Just a quick follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. Then that's related to the state agencies. What about the relationship to the federal assets that are on the ground today?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, you know, federal agencies, you know, typically are, you know, sort of housed along or managed along county boundaries too, or state boundaries. And so, you know, particularly speaking to the USDA NRCS, they have moved towards a watershed approach. They've, you know, a couple of initiatives recently, the Mississippi River Basin Initiative is a watershed approach. I know that, you know, they've been supportive, as have been we, with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture's pursuit of this water quality certification concept, and that's on a watershed scale. So I believe that the federal agencies will also be supportive of this. Okay, Madam Chair, I'll continue. So here you see just the amounts again, and you can see, as is the case for some of the other budget categories, the numbers are have decreased over the last couple of biennium when we had some very challenging state budget situations. And at this point, the governor's budget is proposing no increase or decrease in this budget category, except for that one item, which is the One Watershed, One Plan initiative. Madam Chair, members, this budget category, board administration, agency operations, as is described in the documents, includes really all of our programs. And so at some point, if you're interested, we can break this number down into the various programs that we have that require state agency staffing to conduct. I just wanted to highlight, you know, of course, that includes not only the program specifically, but also the communications and information technology and so forth. We do have in the governor's budget recommendations a small recommendation of $125,000 per year to enhance our internal control systems, you know, with the additional expectations that are being placed from things like the Office of Grants Management about the policies on how we manage and verify and reconcile our grants, as well as just the accounting standards that, you know, keep evolving, that we want to make sure that we have not only things inside of our agency running as well as they need to fiscally, but also we are being asked to do more of that in evaluating how our local governments are spending our state funds. So we have received a recommendation here of one FTE to add to our staff to take on this responsibility. And again, you can see the chart here shows the spending history. All right, I'll move on to Land and Water Conservation Projects budget category. This is really one program, if you will, in this budget category. And Representative Hansen mentioned it earlier, the cost share program. This program was established.
Mr. Jasky, I think this might be a time to take a break, because you are going to be back next week. So, members, I just want to talk to you about Tuesday. Mr. Jasky will be back then, and one of the things I have asked them to do is we've seen the inputs, and we budget on outcomes, and so that's what we will concentrate on next week. We will have in the morning we will have Bowser with us, and in the evening we will have the zoo and the conservation corps, neither of which I think will take a lot of time. We will make sure that there's time for public testimony about all three of these subjects or areas, and So do you all have questions about Tuesday? Anybody have any questions? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you lay out a roadmap then? You've kind of done that, and I appreciate that, of the different evenings that we'll be meeting. So the overviews, when we get into the bigger ones of DNR and PCA, what's our timeline, and will we have those overviews like this one in the context of the governor's budget? And then at what point will we actually get, I guess that question would be, what's the timeline of that? That would be my first question, and I have a follow-up.
Well, there was a schedule put in folks' charts, folders last week, or last session, and we will make sure that we have scheduled out through March 5th, and we will have all of the overviews relating to the governor's budget with outcomes and outcomes for clean water, outcomes for heritage. We should cover that all under this schedule, and we'll just just make sure you get another one. So it is laid out.
Okay, Madam Chair, and that's the overview for all of our agencies by March 5th?
Well, what the plan is to have it done before the February forecast is done, but the last two hearings will be basically mop-up, where we want to drill deeper into a subject, and it didn't get done during one of these hearings. And we will ask the public to comment on the overall. Right now, we're going to get comments on individual budgets as we go through, but there will be an opportunity to comment on the big picture on the 28th and the 5th, or 28th or 29th, whatever. It's the Thursday and the Tuesday.
Okay, and thank you, Madam Chair. And I was handed the schedule now, and I apologize for not recollecting it. And then at what point will we get our budget books? Are we going to get traditional budget books, and do you have a timeline when you think we'll get those?
Now, that I don't know. I know there's some. Oh, I understand it's going to be on Tuesday. Hopefully. We heard some issues about reconciling that need to be done, and then we'll get them.
And, Madam Chair, will you be working off the governor's budget? That'll be your budget, or will you be developing a completely separate one, or are you going to use his as a roadmap for you?
I'm sure we're going to use the governor's budget as a roadmap.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Corkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just sharing a concern. You know, by starting evening meetings this early in the session, I'm sure you're aware that you will be interfering with a number of traditional events that have occurred during the evening, during session, and I realize that you have a lot of work to do and it's maybe unavoidable, but it certainly puts some of the folks that come to St. Paul, and those of us live in greater Minnesota, these folks come great distances to come to St. Paul for their chance to meet with us, and there are evening activities that have been traditionally scheduled early in the session because that's when they can count on our being able to show up for these events, and I just think you're doing a bit of a disservice to those folks that take that time to drive the great distance to be here and see their legislators.
I would welcome them to come to the committee. We can introduce them. We will have obviously have seating for them in this room, and we will recognize them if they choose to come here too. That's another option. Representative Faulk, you would like?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to do a little bit of house cleaning here, I don't think we've approved any of the meeting minutes, and so with that, I would move adoption of the minutes from the meetings of January 10th, 15th, 17th, 22nd, 24th, and 29th.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. With that, the meeting's adjourned.